Mom loved to take us to VBS at some of the churches around our neighborhood. And one time we were at VBS, and it was like halfway through or so, and they were counting the number of people who had shown up. And the numbers are apparently a bit lower than they would have preferred. So there were people in charge of the VBS were standing out at the back saying, What do we do? How do we get some bigger numbers here? And so they thought, you know, one of them said, I saw someone on the road here whose car had broken down, and he had some kids with him. I wonder if they were coming. So she told one of the guys standing around, why don't you go and ask them if they're coming to VBS, and that way, if they are, we can count them. Not, can you go and help them or see if you can fix their car or give the kid a ride to VBS? Just, can you go check if they're coming? Okay, that's what it looks like when religion becomes a performance. When religion becomes a show, when you just care about getting a big number so that you can impress other people. And that's what Romans 2, I think, is all about. So if you look in chapter 2, which is where we are this morning, one of the questions I sent out is, who is this addressed to? Who is Romans 2 in particular talking about? Or talking to? Yes, Jewish Christians are people who had grown up with the law. People who were moral seemed to live pretty good lives, or they thought they lived pretty good lives. We'll get to that in a minute. Let's contrast that to what we talked about last week. Who is a lot of Romans 1 talking about, especially the last half of Romans 1? Who's that talking about? Gentiles, yeah. And not just Gentiles, but what kind of Gentiles? Like, what did they believe? What did they do? I mean, unbelieving Gentiles, people who did some of the worst kinds of sin, people who were godless, people who were wicked, people who apparently had no sense of who the Lord was in their lives, or at least didn't follow it if they did. Okay, so the way I see it is chapter 1 is about the people, you know, to use a common phrase, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of people. The people who are playing loud music at 3 a.m., the people who bash in your mailbox. These are the wicked, unbelieving people that you don't want around in your neighborhood. So here's the contrast. In Romans chapter 2, we're talking about the religious people, the people who do study the law, the people who do think they know God. And that's why it's so interesting to me that in Romans chapter 2, verse 1, what does he say about these people? They had no excuse. Because why? You do the same things. Okay, so let's pause here. Is this literally true? Because if you look back in chapter 1, verse 29, verse 30, Paul lists some of the things that the Gentiles are doing. Okay, for example, he says they're murderers. They murder. Do you think the church at Rome had a problem with murder? I mean, the Bible doesn't say. I'm guessing probably not. Don't know that. Just a guess. What about some of the other things? Were they ruthless? Maybe not to their minds. Were they foolish or faithless? Well, in their minds at least, probably not. And yet in 2 verse 1, Paul says, you practice the very same things. So what do you think's going on here? How would you explain that?
Same way that Christ did, like in the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. The difference between they just go, you're not doing the actual things, your heart's not right.
Yes.
You're doing it in your heart.
Yes.
Guilty.
Yeah.
In some cases they may have.
Yeah. I want to be clear. I don't know this for sure, but just a guess. But yes, you're absolutely right. Even if they weren't literally murdering people or literally being ruthless, it's the same heart problem, I would guess. Yes, James.
Plus, if you go back to one, the closing of chapter 1, it talks about not only those who do the things, but those who approve it as a guide to them. And so that's what I think is the continuation there in verse 1 of chapter 2. Therefore, here's why you are also guilty of trespasses. Because of all the stuff I said, and then even if you didn't do those things,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that segues to kind of a side point I want to make here. In verse 1, Paul talks about judgment. And these people who are passing judgment on others, even though they're doing the exact same thing. It sounds a lot like Matthew 7, when Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged." So let's jump off of what James said. And just as a sidebar here, this is not the main point of the chapter, but as a sidebar, is Paul saying, or is Jesus saying, that we can never condemn evil? No, you know that. Why not? What's the difference? How would you explain someone who says, well, 2 verse 1 says, you shouldn't judge other people. How would you answer that objection?
Claim credit for not doing something if you're going to approve it. That's one side of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, oh, murder is evil or any of those, even like the least of the sins. We want to categorize them from worst to the least. These sins down here are not so bad, so I'm going to approve of those and be okay with you to do these things.
Yep. Yep.
On the other side, you also can't condemn it and then do some of it on yourself. I think there's two sides of it. There's the approval through the approval of people who are doing sin, and then there's also the hypocritical part of saying it's wrong but doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. The only things I would add to that, I think you're totally right. You go back to the very last verse of chapter 1 like you did. Obviously, it's a problem if you approve of sin. So it's not saying you can never condemn evil in any sense. And I would add on for two main reasons. One, it's biblically incoherent based on chapter 1, verse 32. Two, it's not only biblically incoherent, it's also logically incoherent. For example, there's no one, almost no one, who doesn't condemn the Holocaust. There's almost no one who doesn't condemn sexual assault. I mean, even people who say this, it's logically incoherent to say that we're never going to condemn anything at all as being evil or wrong. And even people who say that, for the most part, don't actually practice it. So, yes. So having dealt with that, let's get back to what James said, looking at the big picture of this entire chapter in context. The problem here, I sent out a question about this. The problem, in my mind here, is hypocrisy. It's people who are saying the right things, who think they're doing the right things, perhaps, but their lives look totally different. Their hearts are not in the right place. That's what hypocrisy looks like. So, what's wrong with hypocrisy? Besides, obviously, the Bible says not to do it. God doesn't approve of hypocrisy. That's right. But why? What are some of the problems you get into if you're hypocritical? Yeah. How so? Yes. How so?
If you are saying, no, don't do this thing, and it's wrong, but then, two things later, you're doing something. Even if it's not exactly the same thing, you get it from the main, let's say you stop a kid, father came to walk in the store, and if you if you're not a adult, catch him and scold him and turn out the door,
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And one more, Tony.
Verses 23 and 24, I think, sum it up pretty well as far as, you can boast in the law, or you're breaking the law, do you
Yeah, exactly. We've already touched on this. Great answers, by the way. I wrote down three things that hypocrisy says. One, hypocrisy says that I'm held to a different standard than you are. Says that I'm held to a different standard than you are, which, of course, requires a reason why. Why are you required to hold a different standard than I do? And here's where we get into philosophies like racism or nationalism or judging people based on their economics as all kinds of different sins. If you want to hold people to a different standard than what you're held to, you're going to need a reason for that that's outside the Bible. So that's one. Two, hypocrisy says that I'm better than you are. Hypocrisy says that I'm better than you are, which, again, requires a reason why. Why are you better than I am, or why am I better than you are? And this is where you get into judging the inherent worth of other people. Because if you're going to say you're better, you've got to have a reason for that. Three, hypocrisy says that God's grace has different conditions for you than it does for me. God's grace has different conditions for you than it does for me. So notice what that does. That sets you up as deciding what the conditions for grace are, or who merits, if I can use that word, I probably shouldn't, grace. In other words, what does it do? It sets yourself up as God, right? It sets yourself up as a deity to decide who has grace, who doesn't. So those are some of the problems with hypocrisy. Remember last week we talked about, Jesus said in Matthew 22, the greatest commands are love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Hypocrisy breaks both of those ties. It breaks the vertical relationship between yourself and God. It breaks the horizontal relationship between yourself and other people. So hypocrisy does get to the question of whether you think other human beings have inherent worth, whether they're the same as you, and it sets yourself up ultimately as being a deity, being God. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Therefore, they were special.
Mm-hmm.
All across the board, they were special.
Yeah, they were special people, so keep going. So.
Well, they were God looked on them special. They had special. They had a law. They were just better than other people.
Mm-hmm.
So they could very easily be.
It would be very easy to become prideful. Yeah. Any other comments on that? Have you ever heard of the Old West outlaw Jesse James? You remember him? A legend says that Jesse James loved going to church. Like, every time the door was open, he was going to be there. And this part isn't legend. This is actually true as far as I can tell. When he was beginning his career, he was a member in good standing at one of the local churches in his community, First Baptist Kearney, I think, in Missouri. So at the beginning of his career, he had decided to go rob a bank in broad daylight. So the church thought, that's incompatible with being a Christian. So they decided to send two deacons out to go talk to him and confront him with his sin. So funny thing happened, though. That week, those two deacons, their schedules were just so full that they did not have any time to go see him. So the next week, the church came back for another members' meeting. And just some great surprise, Jesse James walks in the door, and he politely asks that he be removed from the church membership rolls. So after it took a week or two, but to his credit, he eventually realized that robbing a bank in broad daylight is not compatible with being a Christian. Now, the strange thing today is that people don't have the same realization. I mean, when it comes to robbing banks, you know, I mean, people say that's not compatible with being a Christian. The same thing they do as Jesse James is they think, I can live in unrepentant sin and still be a Christian. I can do things that are wrong, but still consider myself a follower of the Lord. That's the mistake that people make today. And it's not a new mistake. It's the same mistake that you see happening in Romans chapter 2. People who are living in sin. If you look in chapter 2 in verse 5, it says, but because of your hard and impenitent heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. I don't know Greek super well, but people who know it better than me say that the Greek for the word stubborn and unrepentant heart used in verse 5, in the Old Testament, those are always and only used to talk about people who are guilty of idolatry. So it's the same heart problem going on, even though there's not a literal idol that they're bowing down and worshiping. It's the same problem. They're putting something else above God. They're putting their own desires, their own traditions, even their own ideas of what God wants, above what God actually commands. That's what's happening in verse 5. Then we get down to verse 6, which says, "He will render to each according to his works." And this is one of the questions I sent out. This one can be a bit confusing because if you remember from last week, verse 17, Paul says, "The righteous shall live by faith." If you go one chapter ahead, chapter 3, verse 28, Paul said, "One is justified by faith apart from the works of the law." And the questions I sent out, I quoted Ephesians 2, which says that we're saved by grace through faith, apart from works, lest anyone should boast. Okay, so now we get to chapter 2, verse 6. "He will render to each according to his works." On the surface, this sounds totally contradictory. But I think we can make the assumption the Bible doesn't contradict itself. If you're a visitor and you disagree with that, that's fine. Happy to talk with you about that afterwards. But for now, let's just assume that the Bible doesn't contradict itself. So that being said, how do you explain chapter 2, verse 6 in light of other verses that talk about the importance of justification by faith? Absolutely. Any other thoughts on that? I mean, I think that's a great summation. Where you started with that answer was to look at the context, and I think that's absolutely right. This chapter is about hypocrisy, people who say one thing and do another. So the way I read verses like 2:6 is that Paul is saying hypocrisy is pointless spin. Like, you're just spinning things before God. The problem is, God sees what you're doing. Like, God sees your heart. And it doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter how much you say you love God or how much you say you serve God. It doesn't matter what you say, because God sees what you're actually doing. And that's what James 2 is all about. Faith without works is what? It's a dead faith. If you're not actually doing what God says, then it's a real question. Do you even believe God? Like, do you even have faith? That's the way I would look at chapter 6. Now, does this mean that you can earn your salvation or that you're saved by your works? No, no, absolutely not. There are several passages we could go to talk about that. I want to just stay in this passage. If you look near the end of chapter 2, like verses 21 through 24, he gets into some specifics about what's going on. For example, he says stealing, he says committing adultery, robbing temples. This is interesting to me. When he lists all of these sins and the things that these people are doing incorrectly, he never says, stop stealing. Or he never says, don't commit adultery. Now, obviously, he wants people not to steal. Okay, he doesn't want people to commit adultery. But he doesn't say, just stop doing this and you'll be saved. What does he say in this chapter? Look at the very last verse, verse 29. Yeah, what he's saying is you need to be born again. It's not just that you need to stop doing bad things, although obviously you do. What you need more than that is a change of heart. Because if you don't have a change of heart, yeah, you might stop stealing, but that lust towards other things is just going to come out in a different way. You might stop stealing objects, but start lusting after someone else's wife. I mean, you can come up with the options yourselves in your own head. What he says here is you need a change of heart. And if you have a change of heart, like he talks about in verse 29, then all these other problems will take care of itself, from stealing to robbing to hypocrisy. If you have a change of heart, that's really what matters. When I was talking about this, prepping this lesson, I was listening to a sermon from someone else, actually a pastor in D.C. And he told a story one time about how, I think it was a Sunday morning after church, there were some young professionals who came up to him and they told him about all the theology they had been studying. They'd been reading all these big, long books by famous theologians, and they've been having reading clubs or book circles, something like that. And they were eager to tell this man about how much they had been studying the Word. So the pastor told them, "Well, that's nice, but we also have some elderly women in the congregation who need rides to church on Sunday morning. And I noticed you haven't been volunteering to get up 30 minutes early to go help them out." And so these young professionals, this group, paraphrasing, said, "Well, yeah, but we'd rather just study and we'd rather read theology and we really don't have a lot of time for helping out the old people. Maybe someone else can work on that." So you know what he said back to them? I mean, just pause for a moment and think, what would you say in that circumstance? I mean, if it were me talking to this group, I would say something like, "Well, you need to check your priorities, or you need to start getting up 30 minutes earlier." That's not what he said. What he said back to them was, "Well, I'm not sure that you're saved. I'm not sure that you're saved." Why? Because God's plan of salvation is drive old ladies to church on Sunday morning? No. It's because faith without works is dead faith. Because if you can study all these theologians as much as you want to, you can even study the Bible as much as you want to, but if that doesn't result in a change in life, like if you're not willing to help your brethren, then that's a sign for serious concern. So that's a lot of what Romans chapter 2 is talking about. It's not mental assent or knowledge that makes the difference. Someone else, not me, has pointed out that, you ever thought about it? Demons would do quite well on a theology exam. The devil would do very well on a theology exam. They're going to score 100 every time. So it's not mental knowledge that makes the difference. I've also heard it being said that it's one thing to know about God. It's another thing to be a child of God. It's one thing to know about God. It's another thing to be a child of God. And that's what Romans 2 is talking about here. Paul is pushing them to say, you don't need to just know about God. You actually need to become his children. What do you think the biggest religion in America today is? What would you characterize as the biggest religion? Statistically speaking, you would say probably Christianity or some form of it. This is partially my opinion. I would say that moralism is a bigger religion than that. According to Lifeway Research, a majority of Americans say that good deeds help them earn a spot in heaven. Or in other words, it's the same philosophy as saying, if there's a God, he's going to accept me because I'm a pretty good person. Or, I've lived a pretty good life, and I've done good things, therefore I'm going to heaven. That's moralism. That's believing because I'm a moral, good person, then I must be okay. And that's the same problem that you see in Romans chapter 2. What's wrong with a religion like that? What's wrong with making moralism your religion? Besides, obviously, God said not to. It's subjective, yes, how so?
Because everybody can determine
what the yeah, absolutely, there's no clear standard here. And in fact, you have to set up a different standard. You have to set up either your culture or yourself or your family or your government. So you're setting up something else in the place of God. You're setting something else up as setting the moral standard that you should follow. So that's one problem. What's the other problem? Or what's another problem? I came up with two. They're more than that. But yeah, Robert.
I can't remember the actual book. I remember what the press said
Yep. Yeah. I like that. Any other thoughts on moralism? Yeah.
Doing good is about doing good for the sake of its inherent rights. If you give, say, food to a food drive, you're not giving food to a food drive because you think God is necessarily food for that. It's one of your inherent rights. You're doing it because it is the right thing to do, and as a Christian, you should strive to do the right thing for its own sake.
One more, yes.
You talked about being subjective, which I agree with 100%, but also, there almost has to be a weight and balance in that, in how much good do you have to get or store up to be able to make it to heaven in that type of moralistic value? Because if you only do one good thing throughout your life, is that enough?
Yeah.
Or do you have to do 1,000? And how many tokens, if you will, do you get for donating to the food bank, or driving the old ladies to church, or changing someone's tire? Who has that scale and sets it, which is also subjective?
Yeah. And jumping off of that, here's the last thing that I had written down here on why moralism fails as a religious system. Even if there were a clear system, even if there were a clear weight and balance like you talked about, I don't think anyone would be able to keep it. I don't think anyone could keep a clear moral system. The theologian Francis Schaeffer proposed a thought experiment one time. This was back in the 1900s. So he said, if you have a tape recorder wrapped around your neck, I know we don't use tape recorders, but imagine you had a tape recorder wrapped around your neck, and this tape recorder only recorded your moral pronouncements against other people. This tape recorder is only going to record when you say, well, they shouldn't do that, or he should do that, or she should be here when this happens. Like, it only records your moral judgments on other people. Okay, at the end of your life, God takes off the tape recorder and plays it. How many of you feel like you could pass all your moral judgments on other people? I mean, I couldn't. Even if there were a clear moral standard, even if you invented a moral standard yourself, you couldn't keep it. So that's why moralism fails as a religious system. So, the good news is, that's not what Paul leaves us with. He doesn't leave us with just moralism. But before we get to the good news, we have to finish up with the bad news. So if we jump to verse 24, what's the result of all the bad things that are happening here? What's the result of the hypocrisy that we see in this chapter? Verse 24, yeah. So what's their sin that they're committing here? And in the questions I mentioned, there's a Ten Commandment in particular that jumps out to me. If you don't think of the Ten Commandment, that's fine. But how would you describe the problem here? Blaspheming is kind of an old English word. But yeah, Tony. Absolutely. Any other thoughts? What sin are they committing, or what's the problem with blaspheming? What is blaspheming? Why does he use that word? Any other thoughts on verse 24? Yeah, Wade.
They're keeping his name holy. If you are at least declaring to others that you are
And the Ten Commandment that applies to that is taking the Lord's name in vain, right? We think about taking the Lord's name in vain as being just saying a bad word or using a word that you shouldn't use. I think there are multiple ways that you can use the Lord's name in vain. The Jews here in Romans chapter 2 were taking on the name of God on themselves. They were claiming to be followers of the Lord, and yet it was in vain, right? They weren't actually following him with their whole heart, which is what verse 29, verse 28 say. So even if they wanted to, they're taking the name of the Lord on themselves, but for no purpose, but incorrectly. So it's taking the name of the Lord in vain. So that's a problem. The other one is what Tony mentioned, is just that they were supposed to be this light to the nations. They were supposed to show people in some small way what God looked like. And they were falling down on that. And then other people were looking at that and saying, I don't want any part of that kind of religion. If that's who God is, then I don't want to be a part of that. Yeah, Casey.
So I also think it undermines the glory of his office. People are not going to see. The only folks can see other than, well, back then they could see God's glory, but in things in the nation, in the different nations. But today, as New Testament Christians, the only way the world is going to see God's glory is authenticity through his people.
Yep.
And it severely undermines that.
Yep. Yeah, Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, had a quote one time. I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. And it's because Gandhi saw people doing like this, people who were not representing the Lord well. So, yes, comment? Yep. Other thoughts? So I would give you two main thought questions here, not for public discussion, but just ask yourself, the past week or so, one, how have you shown people who God is? The past week or so, how have you shown other people who the Lord is? Maybe that's sharing the gospel, but maybe it's not directly sharing the gospel with your words. Have you shown other people who God is? Two, is God misunderstood by someone because of you? Is God misunderstood by someone because of who you are or because of what you've done? Those are two thought questions that I think will help us make application from Romans 2 and live the way that Paul encourages us to. So that's verse 26, 24 through 25. So now we get to the end part of the chapter. I've already touched on this a bit, but somebody want to read verses 25 through 29, because we've talked a lot about the bad news and about what not to do. So here we get to the good news and the happy ending to the lesson. So verse 25 through 29, anyone feel free to take it. Greg.
Having the letter of the law and circumcision are a transgressor of the law. outward in the flesh, but he who is a Jew, is one inwardly, and circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter. And his praise is not from men, but from God.
So here's the good news that Paul gives you. It's not that you need to be perfect in order to be saved. It's not that you need to stop being like the Gentiles, playing loud music at 3 a.m., doing drugs. It's not that you need to stop doing that so much as you need a new change of heart. You need to be circumcised in the heart. That's the solution to what Paul is talking about here in Romans chapter 2. The problem with the Jews is they thought that their goodness was the basis of their salvation. Their ability to keep the law was the ability of their was the basis of their salvation. Problem here is they weren't good. I mean, nobody is good. Romans 3 verse 23 says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So if you think your goodness is the basis of your salvation apart from Christ, then you're falling into the same trap that the Jews did. They needed Jesus and a regeneration of their heart. And this, I think, can be deeply encouraging to us, because deep down, we know that we have sin too, right? I mean, there's some mornings that you probably walked in the church doors and thought, I haven't been perfect this week. I haven't represented the Lord well this week. There are mornings, I think, all of us walk in the doors feeling that way. So the encouragement to us is that Paul isn't saying you've got to be perfect. He's saying you need a change of heart. And then let goodness flow from that. Now, should you do good things? Should you represent the Lord well? Yes, absolutely. That's what we've been talking about all morning. But let that goodness flow from the fact that you've been saved, from the fact that Jesus has cleansed your sins. And because Jesus has already paid the price for our sins, because we've been made righteous, then live that way. Live in a way that glorifies God, in a way that gives honor to Him. And Paul talks about this himself. There's a fallacy here that shall we sin more that grace may abound? Absolutely not. In Romans chapter 6, we'll talk about that. So you don't go to the other extreme. Put a pin in that. We'll come back to that in like 3 weeks. But for now, let your goodness flow from the fact that you've been saved rather than going in reverse. The problem with the Jews is that they tried to go in reverse. Any other thoughts on 28 through 29? Or 26 through 29. So let's talk about practical application here for a moment. We've talked a lot about the historical context, the textual context of this verse. Let's think about how you avoid hypocrisy in your own life, in our own lives. Because here's the thing about hypocrisy. No one thinks they do it, right? No one thinks they're a hypocrite. I mean, I've been in church all my life, but 24 years. And I thought over the past week, how many testimonies have I heard? How many confessions have I heard? And how many of them were about hypocrisy? And I don't know about you. I don't think I could come up with even one where someone confessed to the sin of hypocrisy. So nobody thinks they do it, right? No one really thinks they're a hypocrite. So how can you tell? What are the warning signs that maybe you're falling into the same trap that the Jewish Christians or the Jews of Romans chapter 2 fell into? Yeah.
So looking more at other people, what they're doing wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you need to be careful of where your focus is. Yeah.
Sure. But trying to rationalize how the thing I'm doing is different from what I've told myself not.
Yep. What else? What's a warning sign of hypocrisy, or what's a question you should ask yourself?
Ask the question.
Ask the question, yeah, am I? Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
From salvation, from your reflection, that is
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think this brings us to something that I know personally I struggle with, and that's true self-reflection. Mm-hmm. When you truly look at yourself and you say, where am I struggling with? Where are my sins? I mean, that's not an easy conversation to have.
No.
And so doing that is probably one of the only ways to be able to see if we're truly being hypocrites. Mm-hmm. That true self, godly self-reflection.
I think a companion piece to that kind of searing honesty is to think about warning signs. Is to ask yourself, am I ready to help this person overcome this? And it also takes a lot of guts to ask that question.
Yeah. Other thoughts? I'll take one more comment if anyone has one. Appear not to be any. Okay. I wrote down four questions here, and I agree with everything that has been said. Fantastic stuff. I would propose four questions. One, do you read the Bible and think about other people or yourself? When you're reading the Bible, do you mostly think about yourself or do you mostly think about other people? That's one. Two, when you do wrong, where does your heart go? Do you become resentful or repentant? When you do wrong, do you become resentful or repentant? Three, do you correct others for the same sins you haven't dealt with? Do you correct other people for the same sins that you haven't dealt with? And dealt with obviously can mean different things depending on the sin, you know that. But if you haven't appropriately addressed your sin, do you correct others for the exact same thing? That's three. Four, who do you blame for your failings? Who do you blame for your failings? Because deep down, we all know that we fail. We all know that we mess up. So what do you do with that? Who do you blame for your failures? Those are four questions that I think get to the heart of hypocrisy and being able to evaluate yourself objectively and know if you need to make correction. I have 3 minutes left, so any comments before we close? Any last thoughts? Yeah.
I just want a clarification.
Yeah.
When you read the Bible, do you think others or of yourself?
Mostly. I mean that in the sense of, if you look at chapter 1, Paul lists a lot of sins. If you look, like verses 29 through 30, also chapter 2, 21 through 24. So when Paul, God, is listing out some of the things you shouldn't be doing, when you read that, are you thinking, well, so-and-so does that, so-and-so does that, so-and-so does that? I think a better way to read that is to first ask, am I guilty of this? Like in verse 29, am I guilty of malice? Am I guilty of deceit? Am I guilty of strife? Now, should you look out for your neighbor? I mean, yes, obviously, that's part of, you know, church discipline. But your first concern is making sure that you're right with the Lord. That's why Jesus says, take the plank out of your own eye before you take out the speck from someone else's eye. Any other questions, clarifications? Cool. We have 2 minutes left, so we'll ring the bell in two. But you can go ahead and take your break, go to the bathroom, get water, and be ready for the next service.